Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators and have been working for the last 25 years. We've worked with just about every major publisher in the business, and we've published somewhere between 50 and 75 books. And we've all taught illustration at the university.
Each week, we pick a fascinating topic on illustration, and we argue about it, we yell at each other, and we hug it out at the end.
Sounds good. Well, let's get right down to it, because Will hasn't told us what the topic is today, and it's his.
Whoa, dying, you can't just do that.
I'm dying to find out.
You got to have a little banter.
We got to banter okay. A little bit.
Let me ask you guys this. If you... We got an email, and I saw Lee responded to it, but the email was, do you have anything in place to save your artwork, your personal sketchbooks or your personal art in case there's a flood or a fire or something like that? Hmm. And I liked Lee's response, but I want to hear what Will thinks. Did you see Lee's response to that?
I did not.
Let me orient the viewer. I said you should, I had a three-part response that said you should, number one, have insurance. If you're a homeowner, that means you'll obviously have homeowner's insurance. But if you're a renter, that's the one that gets people a lot because they don't think they need to do anything like that. You need renter's insurance if you're running an office out of your home and you're renting a place. You got to have renter's insurance. And you got to log everything, take pictures and keep receipts and all that stuff for both the computer stuff and then original art and all the other supplies that we have. That stuff's expensive and it's hard to replace it if something happens. I have known two people who their whole studio burned down, everything lost.
Wow.
Crazy. And then so the second step to that was Dropbox, just having some kind of electronic backup and make sure it's offsite. Don't think you're just going to back it up to a hard drive on site, because then if you know the fire or flood gets it, it also gets your backup. So you know, I use Dropbox, but there's a number of them. And then third, I can't remember what the third thing was. What was it?
Dropbox. So insurance.
And then try to save stuff if you can, because they were asking, should I try to save something if it's a threat to your person, bodily harm? If something's on fire, just get out. You know, I had a tree fall on my studio 2 years ago. You guys remember that?
You're the right person to answer.
Huge, giant tree landed on my studio, and the roof was supporting it, and all my computer gear was underneath the path of the tree. And so I made the decision. My wife was freaking out. I was like, I'm going to run in and get it. So I ran in there, unplugged it, and just, you know, did it as fast as I possibly could, but probably not a great call.
Wow.
Yeah. So let me tell you this. Something that happened recently was 3 years ago, I did the first, my first Inktober Travelers piece, where I did 31 different characters all on this giant piece of paper. It was actually two sheets of paper together, and the length of it's probably 4 feet wide, 5 feet wide. It's huge. And I scanned that in. The original never got lost. I still have the original, but I scanned it in, and then I spent a week coloring it and adding color and adjusting things and stitching all the scans together. And I put all this in a folder. I called it Inktober 2017. And I got the files printed, sent everything off to the printer, got the prints back, and tucked that into bed. That project was done, right? And I save everything on Dropbox. I use Dropbox for my all my current project files. When a project's done, I usually stick it into a hard drive, like a external hard drive. But anything that I'm currently working on. But to be honest, I haven't been up to date. So I'm like 2 years behind sticking old projects into the hard drive, right? So I go to make my Drawings 5 book, and I want to include the artwork that I did for this print in the book. And so I go to the 2017 Inktober folder to pull that file out so I can reformat it for the book. And the folder is gone, completely vanished. Search the hard drive, nowhere to be found. And I'm like, oh, no problem. It was on Dropbox. Dropbox has a feature where it will retrieve deleted folders. So somehow someone accidentally deleted this folder. It could have been me, could have been assistant, could have been the dog. I don't know. So I go into Dropbox and I do a search in there in recently deleted, and it's not in there either. Uh-huh. And I find out that it was probably deleted outside of the window that Dropbox saves the files. So it's a they'll hang on to stuff for a month, for 30 days. And then if you don't retrieve it after 30 days, then you then it's lost. Then it's just, it's gone forever. So here I am sitting here like, well, I could scan the artwork again and I could recolor it and then I'd have this finished piece, or I could scan one of the prints that I had made, but then it wouldn't be as nice quality. It wouldn't be as crisp as the original digital file. And then I remembered, I bet my printer keeps an archive of all their jobs. So I called them and I said, this job that I sent you 3 years ago, do you still have the files archived somewhere on hand? And they're like, oh, hold on, let's track it down. And it took them about a week and they got back to me and they said, yep, here it is. Here's all the PDFs that you sent us of these print files.
Wow.
And I was able to get them back.
Sweet.
But I tell that story just so you know that if you're using Dropbox, any sort of like cloud backup, they usually only hang on to things that get deleted for like a month. So you kind of have to stay on top of that.
Good point.
And pay attention to what's missing and what isn't. I don't know how best to do that. If there's some app or program that can notify you when something's been deleted, get an email or something. I'm not sure.
That's a scary story to rely on your printer to be like, do you possibly, I've lost some files in the past, but that was before I started using, at first I was using Mosey Online Backup and now they got bought out by Carbonite. Mm-hmm. So I have a subscription to Carbonite, but I also have a subscription to Sync and it's like Dropbox. And I save everything to Sync on my own. And that's where my working files are. Like I keep them there. I keep them on my hard drive, keep them on Sync, and have Carbonite. I'm like, nah, because I'm all digital. I'm not taking any chances.
Yeah.
And you know, the neat thing about the online cloud storage is the redundancy that they have built into the system. So they are protecting even against local disasters because they have servers in multiple cities where they make duplicate files. So anytime they back up a piece of your artwork, their servers send it out to other cities to back it up as well.
Right. I also have Carbonite too. And I went and checked Carbonite and it wasn't on the Carbonite either. So
why is that?
Again, if you delete a file.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. It just thinks usually, you don't want it.
That's
like,
right.
Like if you're basically the reason you get this stuff is if your computer like falls off your desk and something happens and
gets stolen,
you can't retrieve anything.
Fire.
You just go, you know exactly what's going on. You can go there and retrieve it. But if something gets deleted without you knowing about it 2 months ago, you just don't know.
Yeah.
I have that happen where I don't actually lose it, but I have accidentally flattened a very important file, like a cover, and you don't know it. And then 2 months go by and all of a sudden the only one that Dropbox has is the flattened one.
I've done that.
That's bad.
Or I saved a lower res version over the high res.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a nightmare. That is a nightmare.
I've had a few pieces that just won't make me want to cry over the years.
Right.
Why'd you bring this up?
Yeah, let's get to our topic. What's happening?
You wanted banter. Will, I gave you banter.
You gave me bad banter.
Let me just mention this before we go into today's topic. You know what's funny too, before I get into that? The person listening to this topic right now, listening to this podcast, knows more than Lee and I do because they read the title and they read the description of today's episode.
That's a nice point.
So right now they're sitting with more information than we are. But if you do have a question for the podcast, from time to time, we we like to do an episode where we answer questions. Maybe we'll have that be a segment for each podcast. But if you do have a question, just go to svslearn.com, scroll down to the bottom and click on contact us and just type in the subject line podcast question or question for the podcast, something like that. And then you'll get to us and we will answer it. I will say though, if it's something urgent, this is the probably the least urgent way to get an answer for a question, because we record these podcasts sometimes months ahead of schedule. So you'll be waiting for that answer. so if it is urgent, just type in urgent and maybe one of us can get back to you sooner than you waiting to download the episode.
So here's a good segue from that. Mm-hmm. Is today's podcast topic comes from Griffin. And so it's a question that we were asked on svslearn.com, sent to the info@svslearn.com. And we have Mia, who answers all those emails or looks at all those emails and forwards them to the right place. And I often think when we answer one on the podcast, is the person who asked it still listening to our podcast by the time we answer right. it and get it out?
Answer is yes. They all stay forever.
I really hope so, because, you know, I mean, today's topic is definitely coming from Griffin. I hope you're listening. And the working title so far, we might change this, but it's what do I do after I've learned to illustrate? And I'm going to read a really quick little letter, and it says, it's really just one big question I have. What do art students do after they graduate? I don't feel I'll have the skills to be a pro after graduation. And I think that is the case for many artists. Should we just find a job to pay the bills and keep working on our art until we're ready for more art-related jobs? What would be some sort of low-tier illustration jobs if there is such a thing? That's it. Thanks, Griffin. And I know that we've talked about similar things to this before, but this is a question that every single art student wonders about from the very beginning. I mean, they wonder about it before they go to school. They wonder about it while they're in school. They wonder about it as they're approaching their final year.
Their parents wonder about it.
Their parents are wondering about it.
Friends are wondering about it.
Friends are wondering about it. And you know, when you're an art student, you have to defend your choice of major, right? You're like, wait, you're an artist? What are you going to do? I'm sure there's an answer, and I'll get back to you on that. And then they email us and ask the question. I don't know. I'm writing the rest of the story. What am I going to do? Right. And I remember feeling that way. I remember feeling that way all the time. And I was always very surprised that when I would try to bring something like that up in class, often the teacher would sidestep the question. You know, I had a few teachers that were really good at talking about it. And often the answers were still really vague. But I hope that we can really shed some light on this and give you guys some answers. So before we get going, I just want to tell Lee and Jake kind of what I have planned. I want to talk about, I want to get your ideas on first, but I'm going to be reading a six-step game plan. Mm-hmm. towards when you guys are done, kind of, you know, I'll correct your wrong answers with that and set everybody straight. And then I have, I want to talk about levels 1 through 10 artists, what that looks like and what their lives look like. And so I have some descriptions to read there too. A level 1 would be starting out in elementary school. A level 10 would be obviously the highest that you can attain.
Will Terry.
I don't think so. I would not put myself at a level 10. So the one of the questions here was low tier illustration jobs. What are your guys' thoughts on should someone when they get out, should they find an art related job? Should they find any job? Should they, you know, they got to pay the bills. What would be your guys' advice on the job part?
That is a good question, because I go back and forth on this, and I think it comes down to sort of our last episode topic, like, do what you want to do. Like, what is it that you want to work on and do that thing? So if you can find an entry-level job that's close to that, where you're doing like a small portion of it, like, say, eventual goal is like art directing video games. You want to you want to be an art director at a video game company, then any sort of entry-level job having to do with that would be perfect, because someday as an art director, you'll be able to say, well, I worked this scrub job, you know, at a no-name video game company, and I saw how things worked there, and I saw how it was on the ground floor, and so I know, you know, you take all that information with you as you get up to that high level. If it's illustration, if it's like, I want to do book covers, you know, that's something Lee's working on right now, then there's no entry level like book cover jobs. It's you know, if there is, it's somebody who's probably not going to pay you, or if they are, they're not going to pay you much. The book isn't going to be published far and wide. It's probably self-published, or, you know, that's as low as you could go. So perhaps that's something you could do, but it's not going to be your job. It's not going to pay enough to be your job. So you're probably going to have to take a job doing something else that pays you enough to survive while you take on these entry-level jobs. One thing you have to be cautious and aware of is taking a job that in the creative field saps creativity.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you think, well, I'll work all day doing, you know, this semi-creative thing, and then I'll spend my nights and my weekends working on, you know, book cover designs, you might not have the creative energy left to put into your craft. You might just, you've poured it all into this tangential job, and there's just nothing left over for you to put into your work. So sometimes maybe the best option is to get a job that requires zero creativity. You can sort of show up. You can just do it.
So you're saying, like, that, I mean, like managing a fast food joint,
or
working as a clerk at a Home Depot or
preferably under that one, you want as little responsibility and effort as you can get.
Yeah, if
you're saving yourself basically for
to come home and like, oh, I can't wait to get drawing when I get home.
Right. And really your mindset needs to be, yes, my main job is mastering my craft. I'm just doing this other stuff for rent, food, you know, going to the movies every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my early graduate college advice, is spend the majority of your creative energy doing the thing that you want to do and you want to be paid for and you want to be a level 10 artist at, whatever that is. Or get a
you're saying, job. I just want to break in. You're saying do that on your own. Start working on that thing. So
working on it on your own.
So let's just take children's book illustrator. I want to be a children's book illustrator. I'm about to graduate. So in that example, you're saying start illustrating your own books in your spare time.
Or doing the types of illustrations that would build out the ideal portfolio
for that. Okay.
Yeah.
And then get the Home Depot job.
Mm-hmm. Or if you're wanting to get into some sort of industry job where there is like room for advancement within a company.
Mm-hmm.
So animation, TV, you know, animation, feature animation, video games, you know, those sort of things where you get hired by a company, you transition between companies, then the sooner you can get a job in one of those industries, the better you're going to be overall if your plan is to live and die in that industry.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Lee?
Same. I you know, it's interesting because when I was in school, I would think just any art job is going to be a good one. And that was the criteria, but it's so exhausting, and it can, I think not only from exhaustion point of view, and you don't get new portfolio pieces in the area you want, but just in terms of your thinking and how it can derail you to do art jobs that are totally separate from what you really want to do. So I think it's important to keep them separate, especially the more fine art you are, mm-hmm. the less you want to go for that low-end commercial job, because those are horrible and they really beat you up quite a bit and control the imagery. And over time, your images will change and maybe a way that you don't like.
So the fear, what I'm hearing from you guys is the fear of getting an art-related job. Is that what we're calling it? Kind of like a job that's ancillary to what you really want to be doing, but it is technically an art
adjacent
job. Art adjacent job. So some of those might be, just to give some meat to this discussion for those listening, I've known people that have worked as an artist for a grocery store chain where they were making signs, but they could make kind of creative, do a little illustrations along with the signs. Malls, institutions, schools, libraries, museums. I have a friend. We all have a mutual friend, Nate Hale, who worked. I don't know if you know him, Lee, but Nathan Hale worked. He got his start at a museum of all places.
You're talking about the painter.
Yeah.
Nate Hale?
Graphic novelist. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And he did Rapunzel's Revenge and among many. Oh, he did the Hazardous Tales series. But he got his start. Well, he actually got a start because his parents owned a theater in the Round, Playhouse, and then he was making signs for them. That got him the job at a museum as the in-house artist, making signs and murals and different things like that. He got a lot of painting experience there, and then he worked his way into publishing. Amusement parks. A lot of bigger companies have an art department. They need art for a brochure, they need art for some of the collateral material that they make. Most of that work is done by graphic designers, but often they'll hire artists that were trained in illustration, you guys that are listening, if you also have graphic design skills. So you'll get a chance to do some art jobs. So, but what I'm hearing you guys saying, you're kind of warning against those kinds of jobs because you do only have so much creative energy in a day. Now, here's the thing, and I knew you guys were going to go there, and I wanted you to, so you've fallen perfectly into my trap, which isn't a trap at all. It's more of a quandary, I guess, is that I started by working at the University of Maryland because they had an art department. I looked in the paper and saw this job that was available. I wasn't even going to school there. I'm from Maryland. It was 5 miles from my house, and they were looking for an artist to do signs for their for the dining halls. And I mean, it's such a weird job, you know. It's like, well, I'm an artist for a university making menus and brochures and all sorts of things around the food industry on campus. Mm-hmm. It's huge. It's a huge school, and it was a great job for me to learn. And to perfect my craft, but I did not want to come home and draw.
Right.
But that job, that job got me the job at BYU when I was going to school as an art student at BYU, doing the same thing, posters and flyers and brochures for concert management there, where, you know, all the performances I got to make a poster for. And same thing, but I was in school, so I would spend... I'd have my shift was a 4 hour shift, and I had to do in 4 hours, I had to do sometimes 3 or 4 flyers and posters and stuff. And so, I mean, I would come in, I would see the list of things I had to do that day, and I would just jump in. There wasn't any time to get art direction. It was just make a decision, make a promotion, either brochure or poster or whatever, as quick as you could. As good as you could, and then it's done, because the next day you're going to have a whole nother set. I mean, that's how many performances there were at the school, and I think I worked 3 days a week. So it was like 12 hours a week just cranking as fast as I could. And what's funny is I have had students come to me and say and ask this very question, and I've asked them, like, you know, what kind of job do you have now? And one guy, the reason I say Home Depot is because one of my students was an assistant manager at Home Depot and was making – I think he was making like $70,000 or $80,000 a year while he was going to school. Yeah. And he's like, well, I'm going to quit that job because I want to get some kind of a job like I'm talking about. And where do you think I should apply? And I'm like, so you, you would walk away from $80,000 to, and he was also in the running to become manager. Mm-hmm. You'd walk away from that to, you know, to become a $20,000 or $25,000 a year guy at making posters and flyers and stuff. And he's like, well, isn't that what you have to do? And my advice was, no, don't kill yourself, you know, money wise. Like if you've already got a really good job, you go home and draw at night. Right. And he's like, yeah. And so I'm like, well, you're fresh. All your best stuff is going to be for you. But I didn't follow in that. So it's hard for me to, when I think about this, when I thought, and the reason why I really wanted to answer Griffin's question was I give that advice, but I didn't take that advice. You know, I came up from doing, to kind of round this out, I did for that, in the 2 years that I worked that job at BYU, I probably did, I mean, I might have done 500 to 1,000, I don't know what the count is, 500 to 1,000 posters and flyers. Mm-hmm. Well, how much did I learn just, you know, just visual, spatial relationships, making decisions quickly, mm-hmm. you know, and then, and how much of that translated to my illustration career? It's, you can't undo that. You can't have an alternate reality where you can see what would have happened if you hadn't done that.
Yeah. So. You know, that's a good point because I did take a lot of odd jobs, like odd, illustration jobs, and everything made me the artist that I am today. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think there's more than one answer here.
There really is. And that's
well, now that you mention it, I didn't take that advice either. I mean, I was working for, I think there's two sort of answers. If it truly drains you and you can't do what you need to do, then obviously you don't need to be taking a job like that. But I did architectural concept design and found a little niche there where mm-hmm. it was fast, it paid well, it checked off a bunch of different boxes in order for me to start building my career. Didn't take a ton of time, paid well enough to where I didn't have to constantly do it. And so I would, you know, but I didn't care about it while I was doing it. I wanted to make it look good. Right. And then I would turn in the drawings and then I would have a full day or two free to do what I want to do.
Right.
So, but it just depends on what job you find. You know, there's a company in Portland that hires, their video game company, and they hire all the really good graduates out of the Art Institute when that was still a school. And they're so demanding and pay so little that once people got hired there, it was very, very hard for them to break out of there. As a matter mm-hmm. of fact, like most of them stayed there. And these are really talented people that could have worked, you know, at higher end, I think, video game companies or animation companies or whatever, but they're just exhausted. They're working them to the bone and mm-hmm. they're not paying enough to really get out. And so they get in this sort of cycle, I guess. And that's what you got to watch out for.
Yeah. There really isn't a path. And so if you're looking for like, okay, you know, do this step one, do this step two. If you interviewed 100 children's book illustrators and said, what was your path to finally getting your first illustrated children's book assignment? You'd find 100 different routes, you know, mm-hmm. you know, no two are the same. And you'd find people that worked art related jobs or art adjacent jobs. And you'd find people that didn't. Brett Hellquist was one that didn't. And his path was quicker, you know, to success. Mine took longer. I did a lot of jobs that I hated. I remember being really excited to get paid for the first illustration assignments that I ever did. And once that wears off, then you're stuck with the norm of, yeah, I get paid to make art, but I'm making crappy art and this sucks.
Right.
Yeah.
I think if you're, you know, you're in school, you're just coming out of school. If you're looking for a path to follow, that's the entirely wrong mindset. You're not looking for paths. What you want is a map You want a map of the terrain. So anytime you talk to a professional, you just want to know what the lay of the land is. You want to know, my destination's over here, and you can see that there's winding paths all the way going through forests, going, you know, through canyons, going over mountains. But you just need to know where that is, and then you have to find the path to it yourself, because I kind of want to say, like, every person who finds a path to their destination, that path shifts as they leave that path. Like, no one can go through that path like they do, because they'll end up in a different destination. So really, you just need to understand, like, this is what I want to do. These are the skill sets I need to do that. And then you find the way that's going to get you there. Is it that entry-level job, you know, doing posters or doing chalkboards for a restaurant? You know, maybe that does. Maybe that leads you closer to it than going this other route.
We're all different too. And when, you know, when I did those jobs at the University of Maryland and at BYU, all the material that I created would be different than what someone else would do. There were some of those posters that I did, I got really excited about. I mean, you know what I mean? Because a truly creative person has to create to feel fulfilled in their life. You know, we have to make stuff. That's, if you've got that gene, you get that excitement when, you know, you think about the project you're going to work on, you start visualizing what it's going to be like, you start getting excited about the drawing process and the designing process and the, you know, you're going to use these colors. I mean, it's just, I can still remember some of the projects that I did there being really, really exciting. Like, I couldn't wait to clear out a couple of other projects in on my roster so that I could just work on those. Sometimes what I would do, because some of the groups on campus that performed were smaller and they actually had a budget, they had to pay our office. And so I was able to really give them a crappy flyer, you know, just basically text and a piece of clip art. So I could slam a couple of those in 15 minutes each and then save 3 hours or so to work on one that I would actually do a nice illustration on or something, you know.
Yeah.
Which look horrible today. I saved the best ones that are in a flat file, and I've looked at them every now and then, and I'm like, I can't believe that I used to love to do this. But my point is, if someone else had that job, they would do completely different paintings, and maybe on the ones that I really got up for and really loved, maybe they would have hated, you know, and wouldn't have gotten as much out of, I guess is what I'm saying. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right.
So maybe that job actually helped me more than it would help someone else get to the next stage, because I wasn't content doing that. Whereas at some jobs I've known, art related jobs, I've seen people there for, you know, a decade or two. And it's like, they've kind of lost that feeling of wanting to break out and branch out and do something different.
You know, another thing is, as soon as you can get a, like, say you do want to do something like a children's books thing, you're basically isolated. You're working out of your home studio. A lot of children's book creators I know are, they are connecting with other people through Skype or through Zoom meetings or just on phone, just so that they have people to talk to and people to relate to and pick up things from, pick up tips and just understand the industry a little bit better. But perhaps leading up to that point, because it is very isolated, maybe you do take a job where you are working in some sort of studio environment, because then you're getting access to professional artists who are all doing, you know, not all of them, but a lot of them are doing side projects as well. And so you're learning not only from what you're doing, the immediate thing that you're making, whether it's a video game or an animation or something like that, even if you have a job as a PA or, you know, some sort of assistant, you're still learning from what these people are doing, and you're surrounding yourself with these creative types. And so you're pulling all sorts of creative energy from them that yeah. then you're applying to your personal work, and you're learning the thing that you're immediately creating, but you're also learning about the things that they're making on the side, because they're bringing in their projects that they're working on, and they're sharing those, you know, here's this painting, oil painting I'm working on.
So is our advice to take a job and to not take a job?
Yep.
It really is.
Close the country and open the country.
I wish I would have kept a journal on all the things I learned in all my art jobs, both in-house and freelance. You know, like, here's where I learned this from. Here's where I learned this from. It would be so valuable to go back and look at all those things and realize, you know, like, I needed these little mundane tasks and assignments in order to mm-hmm. to learn some of the lessons. I also wanted to just talk briefly about freelance, because I want to make sure, you know, we've talked about in-house beginner jobs, but, and you touched on it, Jake, a little bit, mm-hmm. that there are some like self-publisher projects. I do know someone who feeds their family primarily off of self-publisher children's books and has built a career off of, you know, is very connected with individuals who find him. And, you know, that's something that he's done and creates a pretty good living doing that. And I know he owns a second house, so he's done well. And, and I'm not mentioning his name because I don't know if he'd want me to, but it's okay. But you know, there are self-publisher projects are looked down upon by most artists because, you know, you're dealing with usually the author who's trying to wear the hat of the graphic designer and the publisher. And it often does not work very well. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to get, we've talked about that before. I don't want to go off in the weeds, but what I want to say is there are lots of little freelance projects. There's crowdfunded projects that people need illustrators for that, you know, some aren't going to pay very well. You could do something like even approaching local restaurants and saying, hey, I'd love to make some art for your walls. And you know, I don't need a whole lot of money. I'm trying to get experience. Is there anything that you need? And it would take a lot of, you know, beating the pavement to drum up work like that. But I think that there's a certain amount of mileage that you have to get. I figured before I actually really started doing, you know, well-paid freelance jobs, I had about 1,000 pieces of art or maybe more that I had to get out of my system that were just horrible. And I had to get those, I had to do them and get them out in order to learn the lessons of how to make good art or decent art. Right. Cause even when I was, I've been at this for 27, 28 years, something like that. And if I look at my first 5 years when I thought I was good, I cringe at all that stuff that I did in the first 5 years as a professional illustrator. Mm-hmm. And that was after the 1,000 bad paintings that I did. So the fear that I have for, you know, in giving advice of saying, don't get an art-related job, which I've often said, and you guys, I hear you saying it too. And now we're kind of like, I don't know. But the fear is you won't get enough mileage. You won't purge those bad paintings out of your system. And some of us have more than others. I think some of us learn faster than others.
Yeah, I think that's a valid argument, you know, against what our initial thoughts are.
So the other thing is, it depends on your personality too. For working a regular job, the only job, I got to be honest, I was fired from a lot of jobs. I mean, I would say most of them. Matter of fact, all of them, except for one, which was pizza delivery. Which if everything goes south and the society collapses, I'm going back to pizza delivery. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I would deliver these pizzas and drive past this. I was avid skateboarder, as I still am, and I'd pass these neighborhood ramps and I'd stop and I'd skate for a little while and I'd come back to work all sweaty and they'd be like, why are you completely sweaty? But you know, you're just driving around delivering pizza, listening to music. But I was a disaster in the other jobs. I was a restaurant host. I worked at, you know, a couple of fast food sort of jobs, a couple of clothing jobs. Fired from all of them for various reasons, because I was terrible in that position.
You were stealing pepperonis off the pizzas, weren't you?
Oh man, I didn't have to steal them. I used to make these little, like, you know, like hand sized pizzas and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, I'm gonna get fat if I keep working here. I could just keep making these little deals. But I was a disaster. And I was really, I would, you know, if I had a Home Depot type job, I would be just as exhausted from the Home Depot job. And very unfulfilled, just because I'm just have the personality that I am not good unless I'm interested in what I'm doing. I'm terrible. And that's why I was a bad high school student as well, but a great college student.
Yeah.
And same so here. I guess it really.
Yeah.
Now it just depends on your personality. If I'm not into it, man, it's like pulling teeth. I just don't have the discipline to do something that I really don't want to do.
Yeah. Let me go through these levels because I think this is helpful. I'm hoping this is helpful. I wrote this for this podcast, and it gave me a chance to really think about my journey and the journey of other artists that I've known over the years. I'm going to start with level one. A level one artist is in elementary school. A level two I would put in junior high. I mean, junior high school kids make better art in general. And if you think about the art kids in the art class in junior high, they're just going to make better art than most elementary school students. Same with high school. High school art students in general are going to make better art than the junior high students. And it just keeps going up from there, right? So level four, I would say, this is where you're really beginning on your art career, would be level four. And I would say it's an intermediate college student. Often college art students find small freelance projects here and there. So it's someone who is definitely thinking about making art as a career and who's definitely working hard, because if you look at all art students, every year I would have a class when I taught at the university and it was funny how the breakdown was almost the same. I knew that I would have 3 to 5 really serious students out of a class of 15 or 20, three to five that I was like, you guys actually want to do this, you know? And then in the bottom end, 3 to 5 that I'm like, why are you even here? You know, you don't even belong in here.
Right. Right.
And then the middle people that still don't really know what's going on or what they really want to do, but they're kind of putting in some effort. And so I would say the level four is that top of that intermediate art student, you know, and then level five. So I'm just going to read these because I've written little paragraphs here. Level five artists impress their friends and family, but aren't ready for most freelance work yet. If they bump into the right person or get really lucky, they will get an assignment here or there that is above their ability and will most likely disappoint the client willing to take the risk with them. They can make a significant amount of money in a year through hard work, working for self-publishers and odd assignments, and willing to accept small amounts of money for their time. Their work lacks design, drawing, or rendering skills, or any combination of these. So they're still, you know, you're still on your way up. But a level five artist is going to impress a lot of people, you know. So level six, I would say artists will struggle to find good freelance work, but from time to time will get lucky. Most of the work they find will pay poorly, and they will struggle to consistently pay their bills with their artwork alone. On level six, often level six artists rely on a spouse to make up the difference. Level six artists have to get used to a month here or a few months there of no work coming in, and moving up should be the focus of a level six artist. Level seven, artists are going to have to work harder to find freelance work. They'll often have to take on work that pays moderately, but they can often find enough work to pay the bills. They must fight for the work and attention they get because their work won't attract the highest paying clients. If they're clever, they can get more mileage out of their artwork, but level seven artists have to hustle more than their marketing. more in their marketing. And then level 8, 9, and 10 is just going to, that's really where I see your goal needs to be. Bottom, your goal should really be to make it to level 8. Not, and obviously we all want to be a 10, but level 8 artists can easily find freelance work, but they usually have to advertise for it through paid or direct mail campaigns, online sites, reps, or social media. They can also have thriving print and original art sales. They can collaborate on projects and find success in non-conventional marketing avenues like Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. Then level 9 artists are often getting approached by companies to work on their projects. They can easily sell prints of their work at conventions and online. They often teach at art schools and get asked to speak on panels. They can easily sell their originals or prints in galleries, online sites. They can easily reach their goals on their crowdfunded projects. And then level 10, artists have companies competing to get them to work for their projects. They sell out of printed of their print books and prints. They are often asked to teach at conventions and flown all over the world to present at workshops. They are often approached for project collaborations. Their name is often recognized by non-artist fans. So here's a short list, and you guys can add some to it. But here's people that I would put as level 10. Tony Dottorlese, Scotty Young, Kazu Kabuishi, Mary Grand Prix, Lois Van Bartel, Kadir Nelson, Peter DeSev, Carter Goodrich, and Polly Bernatini, to name a few.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I don't know. Do you guys, what do you guys think of that?
They're definitely level 10.
What's that?
What's that?
What are you, saying those artists, or what do we think of the whole system?
Yeah, those artists. What do you guys agree with those artists being level 10?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say there's a level 11.
Oh, give me it.
Whoa.
Is that when you're dead and you're famous, like Van Gogh?
No, and I don't know if I can only think of one artist living that's a level 11, and the rest are dead. And level 11 is you start defining pop culture, popular culture. So like a Norman Rockwell is a level 11.
Who are we? Are we talking about like a James Jean kind of a guy, or?
I would put him at a 10.
Okay.
A level 11 would be like Banksy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
Where the artwork that he or them are making is so well known that it's.
He probably has elves, right?
Probably. I think that's what it is. It's not an individual, but it's an idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Batman. Anyone can take on the mask. You know?
Right.
So that would be like the level 11. And I don't know if you even want to achieve that level. But back when our media was so much less compartmentalized as it is now. And there was just so many fewer avenues of media to watch, to read, to listen to. Then you could have a Charles Schulz or a Norman Rockwell create artwork that was universally known from a grandmother down to a child.
And just because the medium was the magazine back then, we didn't have television. Or television was just in its infancy towards the end of his career, I believe. But I think it's important to realize and to remember, you know, for those of you who might, you know, if you kind of see yourself as a level 3, 4, 5, 6, wherever you are, just know that every level 10 was a level 1. And then they were level 2, and then they were level 3 and 4 and 5. And they never, you know, every single level 10 was where you are right now.
What level are you guys?
That's dangerous. You can't do that.
Come on, you got to claim it.
Negative.
No. Not gonna do it. None. You have to say what Will and me are, and then we could say what you are.
What was the level 9? What was the level 9?
Level 9 artists are often getting approached by companies to work on their projects. They can easily sell their prints of their work at conventions and online. They often teach at art schools, get asked to speak on panels. They can easily sell their originals and prints in galleries and online sites, and they can easily reach their goals on their crowdfunded projects.
That would be, I think that's it. That's where you guys are.
Yeah. I'd put Will there. I'd put Lee at like a 12.
Defining movements.
You know what's funny about this too is you can, I think you can also be, you can be multiple levels. You can be a level 10 on some areas and a level 8 on others and a level 9 on
others. There's a spectrum.
Yeah, because you're not, to some degree. Most people aren't great at everything. And some people are you know, and this includes, you know, some people are better at the concept in their art. And so you look at their, you look at their artwork, you look at the visual art, and it might not impress you that much, but then you see that what they're able to create financially with their projects. Mm-hmm. And some people don't get it. Some people don't understand why people respond to it and why it's so commercially successful.
Can you give an example of someone like that?
Yeah. So that would be, for me, the example I always go to is Mo Willems. So if you look at his visual artwork, you know, Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, mm-hmm. and all the other stuff that he's done, you strip away the writing and it looks fairly common, or not common, but it looks easy to make.
Yeah. It's not impressive. It's not impressing illustrators.
Right.
Yeah.
But
right. Well, he's not drawing. Yeah. You got some artists like a Tony Dieterlizzi who's like drawing for illustrators.
Right.
You know,
right.
Everyone can appreciate it, but the illustrators are like, yeah, look how he rendered that. Right. You know, look at that design. And,
but I would put Mo at a 10.
Willems, yeah.
He's a 10.
Mo Willems, he's illustrating for a particular audience who may or may not be, you know, that artistically inclined.
Yeah.
That to say, the pigeon design is iconic.
It is.
There's a brilliant simplicity to it, the same way that there's a brilliant simplicity to like a really good quote.
Right.
You know, putting words together, or a simple poem or something like that. Not a simple poem, but, you know, a brief poem or a brief quote where you're just like, oh, yeah, that's memorable.
Yeah.
It's shareable.
He's approaching illustration from a graphic standpoint. It's very graphic, and it's very easily comprehended and consumed.
Well, I'll throw a name out there. Matthew Inman, who does the oatmeal. Level 10. But maybe a level 6, level 5 art style, you know?
Yeah, so go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and I think he'll be the first to admit it too. Like his humor is the product, and his art style is there totally to service the humor.
Yeah, and his art style or his humor would be ruined with a lot of highly polished art styles.
That's right. Yeah.
his rudimentary drawing skills add to the humor.
Exactly.
Another way to say that was the level to his suckiness of as an illustrator helps it be even more funny.
Right. It looks like Gary Larson too.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the drawings are so funny.
Yeah.
But he's not an illustrator. He's not an artist.
I would hate Gary Larson to try to draw better. That would be a nightmare. Right.
Yep. So I have these six things as far as a game plan for Griffin and for anyone else who, you know, is approaching the end of their education in art, be it online or in a traditional school. And these are, you guys can, you know, these aren't the be all end all. If you want to add to or take away, you feel free. But one, I would say, try to find work that you don't hate. So, you know, a job, we kind of already gone over that. Try to find something that you can do to pay the bills that you just don't hate. That's the thing. Because if you can satisfy that part of your life where you're making money, then, and you're not hating it every day and it's not, you know, driving you crazy, then you can come home and work. Two, work on your portfolio and never stop. So the reason that I put these levels in there is to help people understand that, you know, getting to a level 8, 9, or 10 is a lifelong pursuit. It's something that never stops. So you can never, don't ever get in the mindset of thinking, well, once I get my portfolio, then I'll go out and I'll make money or make work. You know, your portfolio should always be changing. Three, constantly share your work on social media. And I use Piper Thibodeau as an example. If you've never looked at her work before, you should check it out. Just sharing her work is what on social media is what got her career. Mm-hmm. And I have to sneeze because I'm having hay fever right now.
Bless you.
Four is constantly network. So you've got to be networking and really getting out there and meeting other people, because a lot of the opportunities are going to come from a friend of a friend of a friend or something like that. So you've got to be connected. Five, contact companies that hire illustrators and be on their radar. So let them know that you're looking for work, be it digital games, board game companies, textbook publishers, children's book publishers, magazines, graphic novels. Be contacting them and letting them know that you want to work for them. Because if your work is great, but they don't know about you, you know, you're never going to get any work. And then always be working on a personal project. And I think if you're doing these six things, then as long as you're really passionate, as long as you're working really hard, as long as you're improving, it's amazing how opportunities kind of just fall out of the work. And, you know, like right now we're still in kind of right in the middle of this COVID-19 lockdown, partial lockdown thing. And I have gotten more offers for assignments than I've gotten in the last.
It's because you're a level 9.
I've been turning down stuff. I've been bidding really high on things. I'm like, even while we're podcasting, I'm getting a message here from this board game company that I'm still negotiating with to work for. And it's just interesting that if I look back at when I was a level 4, 5, 6, the struggle was real. To get work, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. How do I get work? How do I get someone out there to know about me and to want to pay me for my work? And now I don't advertise anymore. And it just happens. I have another guy that wants me to do a children's book. And I probably won't.
A guy? Is that a self-published deal?
No, it's for his company, but it's a smaller company, but they have a pretty decent budget. And it's a book that was already in print and it did really well and they want to redo it. But the point I'm trying to make is the higher you get on those levels, and it really comes down to your portfolio. It really comes down to working on your craft, being the best artist you can be, creating the best artwork you can create. After a while, the word of mouth just, you know, every project leads to another project. And like Lee, you're constantly getting pestered to do tons of children's books and some of them you don't even want to do. And you turn down a lot of work.
That's true.
And Jake turns down work every now and then, right? Do you ever turn down work, Jake?
Yeah, I do.
I'm teasing. You turn down a lot. And that's a great place to be, but it wasn't always like that. And maybe my last little piece of advice would be to be patient and to be gentle with yourself and understand that, you know, becoming a professional artist is a lifelong career. And, you know, you've spent 3, 4, 5 years in art school, and and you're just beginning your journey. Whereas an accountant that goes to school, you know, they get out and they get their accounting job, and you know, they can move up in their job, but basically they, a lot of careers, you get rewarded with the job that you're looking for right out of school. Not all, but some, you know, if you go to med school, most med school students that do well, just come out and they boom, there's a doctor job waiting for you. Is that what it's called? Mm. A doctor job. But for artists, there isn't that. And I think that's what we're getting asked a lot is, hey, where's my job when I get out of art school? And this is this is an hour long way of telling you that there isn't just an easy path like that, but there are definitely things you can do. And the rewards are great if you stick with it. And if you work really hard and if you move up, eventually life can be pretty easy, you know?
Well, the old slogan I like, I always come back to is, easy choices, hard life, hard choices, easy life.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you got to run that past me again. I got to hear that one more time to process. What was that?
Easy choices, hard life, hard choices, easy life. So if you're always choosing the easiest path, your life's going to be harder. And if you're always choosing a harder path, meaning a path that's going to make you grow,
yep,
and it's going to make you be better in the long run, then ultimately you'll have an easier life.
It's funny. When I was a scoutmaster, I used to watch my kids. And one of the things you try to do as a scoutmaster when you take them camping is you try to teach them how to, basically the principle you just said, Jake, you try to teach them to make hard choices so that they can have an easier life just in the setting of camping, right? So they're sitting huddled by the fire. We're winter camping, you know, and the fire, we've run out of wood and the fire's starting to dwindle. And so they're starting to get colder. And this is after I've said, you guys should probably go out and get more wood, you know? And as the adult leader, I have to be willing to be cold with them. Cause if I go out and get the wood, they don't learn anything, but trying to get them to make that hard choice to leave the warm fire, to go out where it's colder, to get the thing that's going to make them warmer is actually pretty hard to teach even 12, 13 year olds, 14 year olds, you know, but it's a solid principle.
Yeah. All right. Well, should we wrap it up?
Let's wrap it. Let's put a bow on it.
Good. Thank you. Good. Thank you, Will Terry. Thank you so much for this topic. Before we start recording, I'm like, just tell us what it is. He's like, no, but you will thank me
after. Just a hint. Just a hint.
Okay, thanks, everybody. Thanks for joining Griffin. Us. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks to Griffin too. But thanks to you listening for joining us today. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com, where becoming a great illustrator starts. And your hosts today have been Will Terry, Lee White, and myself, Jake Parker. And you can find Will Terry on Instagram at Will Terry Art is his handle. Lee White is Lee White Illo on Instagram. And I am Jake Parker on Instagram. Podcast produced by Aaron Painter. You can find his work at painterdraws.com. Podcast edited by Alex Sugg. And that's Sugg with 2 G's. And you can find his work at alexsugg.com. And our podcast video is edited by Daniel Tu. That's Daniel2TU.co, Daniel2.co. And all of our social media and all the behind the scenes sharing of the podcast and everything is done by Lisa Fott. Special thanks to her for that. So if you like this episode, please share it around. Pass it on to your friends and neighbors who are illustrators wondering what they're going to be doing after college or after school. I'm falling off the rails here.
You got this.
Whatever, just share it. And if you want to join in on this discussion, please log in over on svslearn.com, where we have the forum there. You can become a member of the forum for free, absolutely free, and join that community. And there is a thread in the forum specifically about this topic. So if you have anything you want to add or any other questions or something you know, correction that needs to be made, something that we said, you can log in over there, join that discussion, and share your thoughts with us over there. So we'd appreciate that. And I think that's it. Thanks. And we'll see you next time.